What do an undocumented immigrant in the South Bronx, a high net worth entrepreneur, and a 20-something graduate student have in common? Well, according to our next guest, all three are victims of our dysfunctional mainstream bank and credit system. Lisa Servon says nearly half of all Americans live from paycheck to paycheck, and income volatility has doubled over the past 30 years. Banks, with their high monthly fees and overdraft charges, are gouging their low and middle income customers while serving only the wealthiest of Americans. Lisa Servon delivers dispatches from inside a range of banking alternatives that have sprung up to fill the void. Lisa Servon is professor of city and regional planning at the University of Pennsylvania and a former dean of the New School. The name of the new book, The Unbanking of America, How the New Middle Class Survives. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Lisa Servon to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to this idea of really looking at how the middle class, what you refer to as the new middle class, survives?
Well, it's a good question. You know, I started doing this research because I noticed that there was a lot of data talking about people, the difference between people who are banked and unbanked. The FDIC started putting out reports about 10 years ago expressing a lot of concern that 8% of Americans did not have a bank account, and 28% of Americans, in addition to that, were using alternative financial services like check cashers and payday lenders. And the implication was that people who didn't use banks or didn't use them exclusively were somehow deficient, that they didn't know better. And from my research, I knew that people, especially people who didn't have a whole lot of money, knew where every penny went. And so I felt like I really needed to understand why people were making the choices they did. And in the process, I found out that it just wasn't just low-income Americans. It was also a growing group of people who've done all the kinds of things that people who aspire to be the middle class have always done, but they weren't really making it, that they were living in very precarious financial situations.
When you consider how that happened, has that been a slow growth or fairly abrupt?
It's been a slow but steady growth beginning about in the 1970s, and it's really happened. There are kind of two buckets of reasons why. One is that the context in which the American worker works has changed a lot. You mentioned income volatility. So income volatility has doubled over the past 30 years. People are no longer able to predict to the extent that they once were what their incoming money will be from paycheck to paycheck, from month to month. So it makes it very hard to budget and save and plan. On the other hand, the set of consumer financial services that are available to people and that are safe and affordable has decreased. We have a lot more options, but in terms of banks, there's in many cases not very much that's safe, affordable, and reliable for people, especially people who are in that precarious financial situation.
We should say that you know what you're talking about. You actually went out and worked as a teller at a check cashier and a payday lender. And I'm curious as to what led you to do your research that way to get an understanding of what was going on.
That's a good question. Yeah. You know, when you do research, you have to find the best method to match the question you're asking. And this question that I was asking, which was really, why are so many people using alternative financial services like check cashers? Why would they be making those decisions if all of the received wisdom is that these guys are predatory and bad for them? I couldn't figure that out any other way. The big data sets were only talking about the numbers, and I figured that there had to be a story behind it. I couldn't actually become unbanked very easily or make my own situation precarious. And so I figured that the best way to answer that question would be to get as close as to the problem as I could. And I learned a ton working behind the teller window.
All right. So let's talk about what you learned. What insights do you get from working that way?
You know, you see the broad range of people who are coming to the window, both to the check casher and the payday lender. And what I realized was that there were really three basic reasons why people were choosing to use these alternative financial services. And I should say that, you know, later on I went and interviewed a lot of people who were clients of the businesses where I worked and found that about half of them actually also had bank accounts, and another good chunk of them had had bank accounts in the past and no longer did. And when I talked to them about why they were using alternative services, there were three reasons. One was cost. They actually told me that it cost more for them to use a bank than it did to use the check casher, which is completely counterintuitive. The one thing you hear about check cashers is that they're expensive and they're predatory. The second thing was transparency. People felt like it was very clear to them at the check casher and the payday lender what they were getting and how much it would cost, and they often felt like they were being hit with fees from the bank that they couldn't predict. And the third thing was service. They felt like they were served much better and that they were in a relationship with the tellers at the alternative financial services in a way that they couldn't get at the bank. And I certainly, you know, I write about and talk about when I was a kid going to a bank, and my experience of now banking is much different from that, and it's much different from the relationship that most of my customers were receiving when they came to the stores.
So this is somewhat anecdotal, but obviously you dig into it much more in the book. But how did banks lose our trust?
It's a lot of things, and I think, you know, the kind of the exclamation point at the end of the sentence was the financial crisis, right? That even if people weren't touched by banks, by the mortgage foreclosures or directly being tricked, they, you know, that distrust that was already there was amplified. But before that, I think part of it had to do with banks changing the way that they made money. So when I was a kid in the 60s and 70s, you know, banks were pretty boring. They took deposits, they made small loans. There was this golden era of banking in the mid-20th century called the 363 era, people called it, because you knew you were going to get 3% on your savings, you knew you were going to pay 6% on a loan, and the banker knew that he could leave the office by 3 o'clock to get to the golf course. It's pretty different now. And so banks started to realize the interest income that they used to make became less reliable. And in the 80s, they discovered fees. They discovered that they could make a lot of money by providing overdraft protection. Kind of a misnomer, the word protection. They now make about upwards of $30 billion a year in overdraft fees. And there are other fees that they started ratcheting up, monthly service fees, fees for getting a paper statement, all kinds of other things. And so part of it was then once people started getting hit by fees that they had not been hit by before and couldn't predict, that helped build the distrust. And I think the other thing is that deregulation, which started happening in the 1980s too, suddenly banks were able to do more than they'd been able to do in the previous decades. They were able to merge with insurance agents. They were able to work more easily overseas. They were able to branch much more. And so banks got bigger. And partly as a consequence of that, the relationship between the banker and the customer became much more distant. And so people started feeling like the banks were not necessarily acting in their best interests. And I think if we just look over the past few months with the Wells Fargo scandal, in which Wells Fargo was opening accounts and initiating products for people that they weren't asking for, there are lots and lots of stories. It was not a unique event. Lots and lots of stories out there that built on that distrust.
I asked you a moment ago about the distrust, and you talked about the three reasons that the people you interviewed gave you, basically, about why they started to look for alternative financial services. What fascinated me about that is really the craftiness that the public had in navigating the challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what really bothered me and what motivated me to go into the field and do the jobs that I did to do the research I did was this assumption that people must be ignorant or not know better. And what I found by choosing not to use a bank or not to use a bank exclusively, and what I found was that people were really smart. They knew what their options were. Oftentimes, and so I'm not necessarily advocating for check cashers and payday lenders here, but for so many people, they knew that they were their best option. They weren't necessarily 100% happy with them, particularly in the cases of payday lenders, but they felt like they were their best option, and they were being really smart about their money.
In other words, and not to put words in your mouth, but you certainly get this idea in the book that there is the straw that breaks the camel's back, that somebody looks at their statement and sees that they're being charged $5 for a statement and says, all right, I've had enough.
That's right. That's right. You know, not getting interest on savings accounts. You know, I had a guy tell me a story about taking his daughter to a bank the way that he did when he was a kid to start her first account when she was 10 years old, and you know, hoping to go with her every month and deposit $50 and see the interest grow. And when they went back the next month, they saw that there was $45 in the account, not 50, because of that fee. And he just got fed up. You know, so those kinds of stories are happening all over the place. In fact, I heard so many of them as I've kind of walked around the country talking about my work or interviewing people. I actually started a blog, a Tumblr site called moneystories.tumblr.com, just to collect the stories. And it's been really interesting to see anybody can go on and submit a story about their experience with their bank or their credit union or their credit card. Some of them are good stories, but over and over you hear these frustrations and also a lot of desperation from Americans who are really feeling like they're pushed to the edge with debt, with rising cost of living, with work that's less stable. I think it's a really dire situation we're in.
You mentioned something a moment ago that reminded me of a note that I made while I was reading the book, and that is you talked about the experience of what it was like when you went to a bank as a kid and remembered of that experience of walking into a bank. I think you and I are basically the same age, and I have a very similar thought and experience as to what that was like. So you talk about in the book of really how millennials are in a particularly tough spot. And one of the things you note is because they have no ties to what mainstream banks were.
That's right, right. So whereas I and I guess you have those memories of going to the bank with our parents and having a passbook, I teach at a university. I don't think most of my students have ever seen a passbook.
Right.
I sometimes buy them on eBay just because I think they're these interesting, you know, relics.
Yes.
It's like this, you know, this item that you dig up from a time capsule. So, right, there's not that kind of loyalty to a bank. And for millennials, they're in different situations with respect to debt and to money, and they're using a much broader range of tools. Some of them are choosing just to use prepaid debit cards to manage their money. Lots of them are looking for other options, looking for apps like Venmo, which does attach to, you know, does link up to your bank. Actually, you have a bank account, but that allows people to move their money around much more flexibly. And, you know, the if you look at the brands that millennials hate the most, the four biggest banks all make it to that top 10 list. So millennials are not, and this is the biggest generation ever. This is the largest generation, so they're switching banks at much higher rates than other Americans. They're looking for other options, and they're demanding something different from their financial institutions. And banks haven't necessarily innovated in a way that meets their needs.
And the book, I think, ultimately comes out as being quite optimistic because, as you point out, there is a lot we can do.
Right. So there are a couple things, really. One is that there is a lot of innovation that's on the horizon. Some of it's being has been introduced already that's making financial services cheaper, more transparent, more effective for people. I talk about a firm, for example, called L2C. It was bought by TransUnion, which is one of the three major credit bureaus. I think most people know how important your credit score is now, not just for getting cheap credit, but also for getting a job or for getting an apartment if you're a renter. And so they've created a new kind of credit score that takes a much broader range of information into account. And as a result, a lot of people who either had no credit score or had not so great, a subprime credit score, are able to be boosted into a better score that gets them cheaper credit. So here's an innovation that doesn't cost any money to any of us. And if it does get implemented more broadly, will enable people to get cheaper, better credit. The other thing is that I think many people that I talk to gripe about their banks, but there are also other options. I have a button on my website, lisaservon.com, that says how to leave your bank. And, you know, for people who are upset about the fees, there are good options. People who use credit unions, on average, pay much less annually in fees than people who use banks. And there are also a lot of mostly smaller, I would say, but not exclusively, other banks. I write about KeyBank in the book is doing well by their customers that are really trying to serve people and not just make money. But, you know, the thing is that banks' basic motivation, like any for-profit business, is to maximize profit. Credit unions, that's not the case. Community banks tend to be more mission-driven and not to be looking to maximize profit. So that's what people have to look for.
The book is a fascinating investigation. It is titled The Unbanking of America, How the New Middle Class Survives. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Lisa Servon, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing your knowledge. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, The Unbanking of America. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.